Hey, listeners, be sure to subscribe to Calvary Plus on Apple Podcasts if you want access to new episodes a week early and ad-free.
Calvary Audio.
Do you remember the last fight scene in Enter the Dragon when Bruce Lee finally takes on the main villain? The dude with the Wolverine claw instead of a hand? What happens is, Bruce ends up in this maze of mirrors, and he can't tell where the bad guy is because he can't distinguish the real from the reflected amidst the confusion of visual noise. To me, that's what the Rosenberg case is like. There's no scary boss-level dude with a Wolverine claw for a hand. But every time you think you've seen something real, it turns out to be an illusion, a trick of the mirror. Still, you keep looking. You're convinced you'll eventually find the truth. But you just end up deeper in the maze, lost in the infinite recession of images. In the movie, Bruce ends up just breaking all the mirrors until the bad guy's got nowhere left to hide. It's a really cool scene, but we don't have that option. Also, we're not Bruce Lee. Before we get started here, let's do a quick check-in. Last time, we left off on the surprising revelation that the Valdez Spice brothers, the men who hired the gang of hitmen that killed Rodrigo Rosenberg, were actually related to Rodrigo Rosenberg. Let me give you some background. Rosenberg's first wife was a woman named Rosa Maria Paiz. That's P-A-I-Z. Rosenberg and Rosa had actually known each other their whole lives. They grew up together. The two families were very close. Rosa talks about how they would spend practically every weekend together as children and adolescents. A part of that group were Rosa's two cousins, Francisco and Estuardo Valdez Paiz. As with Rosa, the two brothers and Rosenberg were childhood friends, so close that the Valdez Paiz brothers came to consider Rosenberg as part of their family, especially when he married Rosa.
No, lazos de sangre no habían.
We weren't blood relatives, but we had bonds of friendship and brotherhood, which are sometimes actually stronger than blood.
You just heard the voice of Francisco Valdez Paiz, the man himself. His younger brother, Estuardo, died of cancer back in 2019. But I was able to sit down with Francisco in his office for a wide-ranging interview. And in case you're wondering, was it weird to drink bottled water and have a chat with a guy credibly accused of hiring hitmen? Yeah, it was weird. From the beginning of the entire affair, Mr. Valdez Paiz has maintained his innocence. He has an explanation for the part he played in the murder of Rodrigo Rosenberg. Believe me, this is the type of guy who has an explanation for everything. We'll get to his version of what happened in a later episode. For now, we'll focus on his close ties with Rosenberg.
Rodrigo was a guy everybody admired. But with us, he had a unique relationship because he was like part of our family. Despite the fact that he divorced my cousin Rosa Maria, his relationship with us didn't end.
La relación con nosotros continuó.
For example, when the circle of friends was still in college, Francisco Valdez Paiz was watching a game of softball when Rosenberg suddenly arrived to break the horrible news that Francisco's father had been murdered. That's the kind of relationship Rosenberg had with the family. A relationship that persisted as they got older, despite Rosenberg's divorce from Rosa Paiz. The obvious question is, why would the Valdez Spice brothers order the assassination of one of their closest friends, a man they considered a part of their family? Was it all just a horrible mistake? A comedy of errors that ended in tragedy? Or did the brothers have a reason for wanting to kill their cousin? And what about Khalil Musa? If Rosenberg was murdered to cover up the previous murders of Khalil Musa and his daughter Marjorie, were the Valdez Pais brothers also responsible for that crime? Did the brothers have anything to do with Musa, Bandural, and the Colom's alleged money laundering operation? And what about President Colom? Did this discovery exonerate him? The Coloms didn't appear to have any sort of connection with the Valdez Spice brothers, which meant that they must have had nothing to do with hiring the gang that killed Rosenberg. But that didn't necessarily exonerate them from the murder of the Musas. If you feel like you're in that Enter the Dragon maze of mirrors right now, I don't blame you. Carlos Castesana felt the same way. Months into the investigation, he felt no closer to solving the case, to finding the truth. Every single time he felt himself on firm ground, the rug would get pulled out from underneath his feet. The revelation of the Valdez Spice brothers' involvement in the murder felt the same way. It felt more like a misdirection than a breakthrough. Castesana was convinced that there was a deeper truth hidden within the maze. A detail, a clue, a piece of evidence, something he hadn't seen yet. The discovery of which would break the case wide open. He turned out to be right, but he had no idea what was coming.
From Cavalry Audio and executive producer Oscar Isaac, I'm Edgar Castillo, and this is The Rosenberg Case. You're listening to Episode 6, The Truth.
By this point, the fact that Rosenberg was in an illicit love affair with Marjorie Hildebrand had gone public, splashed in headlines and news reports, probably leaked to the press by Sandra Colom and her minions. News outlets printed their text messages and milked the story, adding to the general fog of confusion surrounding the case and the investigation. The Coloms and their press shop didn't hesitate to insinuate all sorts of lurid alternative theories of Rosenberg's murder, even suggesting that Marjorie's husband, Alejandro, found out about the affair and then killed both his wife and Rosenberg in revenge. CSIG investigators actually explored that path, but found nothing to connect Alejandro Hildebrand to either of the murders or to the money laundering allegations made by Rosenberg in his video. Far from advancing the investigation, the only thing the release of the text messages really did was drag the Musa and Rosenberg families further into the spotlight. Well, the leak of the affair did accomplish one other thing. It strengthened the government's position. Not because it proved President Colom innocent of murder, but because, like a slick magician, it gave him the chance to hold his hand out and say, "Watch this hand. Don't look over there. Watch what I'm doing with my hand over here." And sure enough, by the fall of 2009, the Coloms felt pretty good about their situation. And Roberto Isurieta, the administration's crisis manager, felt pretty good about a job well done. From the beginning, Isurieta and the Coloms had tried to frame the Rosenberg accusations as part of a conspiracy, a right-wing elitist plot to destabilize the presidency. they had come up with a slogan that encapsulated the story as Colón saw it. Los ricos están contra el gobierno de los pobres. The rich are against the government of the poor. Colón and his cronies worked hard to feed into that narrative. The president ominously called his enemies, quote, dark monsters in a cave that you can hear but not see. Despite Sandra Colom's shenanigans in the first month of the crisis, the administration had mostly maintained discipline and stuck to Isurieta's talking points. Here's Roberto Isurieta.
Sandra would have loved to go that way, but we did not want to. We did not want to solve this on the street, despite that the opposition told us, okay, we will define this on the streets. So it was very tempting to respond, fine. If that's the place of the battle, we'll do it. The position of the president was no. I want the international support. I want all the resources, independent resources, to help La CICIG and everybody else to investigate and to find out.
It was working. For Isurieta, the long sleepless nights and countless cups of coffee had paid off. The president's approval numbers had stabilized. The protests had started to die down. And the calls for Colón to resign had lost their initial impact. Only his most ardent enemies were still calling for his head. But even Mario David Garcia had started to focus his radio show less on the Coloms and more on bashing Carlos Castesana and CICIG. Isurieta had never wavered in his belief that the charges Rosenberg leveled at the president were completely spurious.
I was totally convinced, and I'm still, of course, I am, that he was 100% innocent.
For Isurieta, the accusations would have been infinitely more plausible had Colón began his career in the military or homeland security. But Colón built his political future by implementing social welfare programs in rural provinces and indigenous communities. He was a bleeding heart liberal, not a killer. He didn't even look like a killer. As one Peruvian journalist put it, quote, President Colón doesn't have the face of an assassin. Isurieta's trust was only reinforced when Carlos Castesana met with President Colón to provide him with an update on the investigation. The last time they spoke, it hadn't gone very well. It was right after CICIG investigators realized that Ovidio Batz-Tax, the witness provided by the Minister of the Interior, was a fake. Remember that guy? I told you I'd get his name in there one more time. When the witness revealed that he had been paid off by the minister and that Sandra Colón had been involved, Castesana was furious. He called the president and laid into him, accusing him and his wife of not just interfering in the case, but of obstruction of justice. Castesana had wanted to investigate the First Lady and even bring charges, but he was supposedly dissuaded by Stephen McFarland, the United States ambassador to Guatemala, according to some reports. Guatemala's democracy was in a precarious position, and McFarland didn't think it could absorb another blow. This episode strained the already tense relationship between CICIG and the presidential palace. Castesana didn't trust Colón or his wife Sandra, for that matter. On another occasion, CICIG agents got a call from a witness who claimed to know the true identity of the mastermind behind the Rosenberg murder. Castesana sent a team to meet the witness at a hotel in Chimaltenango, a small town 37 miles west of Guatemala City. The CICIG agents picked up the witness in the lobby and were about to head to their armored car when a dozen National Civil Police officers surrounded the front entrance. Guns drawn and pointed, the cops demanded that the CICIG agents hand the witness over immediately. Stunned, The CCG agents refused the order, and a tense standoff ensued in the hotel lobby. One of the agents managed to send word to Castasana. Afraid for the lives of his people, he immediately called Vice President Espada and asked him to call the cops off. After hours, the police finally put down their weapons and let the CCG agents and the witness go. No one had been hurt, but it had been a very close call. What truly worried Castasana was the obvious fact that someone in the administration had been monitoring CCG's activities. They had somehow found out about the witness and tried to prevent CCG from interviewing him. The witness proved to have unreliable information, but that was beside the point. President Colom had pledged to not interfere in the Rosenberg investigation. That pledge had not been honored. It was clear that either the president himself or someone close to him did not want Castasana and his team getting anywhere near the truth. But now, after weeks of investigating, Castasana was coming to inform President Colom that so far, his team had found no link between the government and the murder of Rodrigo Rosenberg. CICIG's investigation into Ban Rural and Rosenberg's accusations of money laundering was still open, but had been placed on the back burner until after the murder itself had been solved. Colom was eager to announce that he was no longer under suspicion, but Castasana asked him to hold off. He didn't want to give the real culprit any indication as to the state of the investigation. So, for the moment, it seemed as if the Coloms were nearly out of the woods. Things were looking good. Sandra Colom was almost ready to announce her candidacy for president. She was keen on hiring Roberto Isurieta to run her campaign. As long as Castasana and his team could find the true author of the Rosenberg murder, the Coloms would be in the clear. What they didn't know was that CICIG's investigation into the Coloms' history of illicit campaign financing was slowly taking shape. It would take another few years to develop, and by that point, both the president and his wife would find themselves in an even bigger crisis. But that's a story for another time. By the fall of 2009, the CICIG team, using information gleaned from dozens of interviews with family and friends, had reconstructed the last days of Rodrigo Rosenberg's life. Based on his actions in the days after the Musa murders and in the time before his own killing, CICIG was certain about two things regarding Rosenberg's state of mind. One, he was clearly distraught. He was devastated by the death of Marjorie Hildebrand, the woman he loved and with whom he was having an affair. Two, he believed his life was in danger. The one question that still bugged Castasana and his team was, if Rosenberg believed that his life was under threat and that he was being followed, why had he embarked on a solo bike ride that Sunday morning when he was killed? Why had he exposed himself in such a careless manner? Especially given that, according to Luis Mendizabal, Rosenberg was about to buy evidence off of a confidential source. Concrete proof that President Colom and his people were behind the Musa murders. For Rosenberg to be that nonchalant about his security just didn't fit. Not with his state of mind or behavior in those final days. For Castasana, it was inexplicable, like so many other aspects of the case. On October 30th, 2009, almost 6 months after the murder of Rodrigo Rosenberg, the CICIG team was dealt a tragic blow. A Guatemalan lawyer named Merlinton Monzon, who had been working with CICIG and who was in charge of prosecuting the case against the gang of hitmen, was shot and killed while driving with his wife. He was 36 years old. Police authorities chalked the murder up to a deadly incident of road rage. But Carlos Castesana suspected the worst. Had Monzon really been simply the victim of an angry driver? Or was there something more sinister at play? The young lawyer had been in charge of prosecuting a high-profile case involving nearly a dozen ex-cops. Was someone trying to prevent Sisig from discovering the full extent of the conspiracy behind the Rosenberg murder? Whatever the reason behind the shocking death, Castesana had had enough. He was tired of the threats, the paranoia. This case was putting not just his life, but the lives of his agents in real danger. After mourning their colleague, Castesana urged his team to discover the truth as quickly as possible, to get this damn case behind them and move on before it cost more lives. But the team would soon face another setback. After issuing an arrest warrant for the Valdez Spice brothers, Sisig discovered that the suspects had already fled the country. Now, the men who had hired and paid the gang of sicarios were gone, and obviously unavailable for questioning. The very fact of their flight from justice spoke to their guilt and complicity, but it also prevented Castesana from learning why they would want to kill such a close personal friend as Rosenberg. With the Valdez Spice brothers gone, and their motive for committing the crime still in question, Castesana was stuck. He had started to privately concede that if he couldn't bring it to a resolution, the Rosenberg case might actually cost him his career. He needed a break, and he needed it soon. Lacking an eyewitness and their chief suspects having fled, the Sisig team decided to focus on a forensic analysis of the phone records involved in the case. Specifically, they needed to trace the origins of the burner phone used to make the threatening phone calls to Rosenberg's cell phone and to communicate with the hitmen. From now on, I'll call it the 577 number. This was the same number that Rosenberg had showed to Luis Mendizabal on May 5th, 5 days before he was killed. The number Mendizabal showed to Sisig investigators upon questioning. Call logs revealed that the 577 number was only active from May 5th until May 10th, the day Rosenberg was murdered. And it only communicated with one other cell phone, the burner phone obtained by Jesus Manuel Cardona Medina, the intermediary, the burner phone he got from the Valdez Spice brothers. Remember, the person who spoke on the phone with Cardona Medina identified himself as Canche, Blondie. This was the inside man, the person who had apparently been tracking Rosenberg, who knew enough about Rosenberg's movements to tell the hitmen exactly where he would be and when. This inside man, Canche, must have been the same person using the 577 number to make threatening calls to Rosenberg. The phone record showed that Rosenberg's personal cell phone had received several calls from the 577 number during that 5-day period. Most of the calls only lasted a few seconds, long enough to make a threat on his life. Just to clarify, the inside man, Canche, only used the 577 phone number to communicate with the gang of hitmen and to make the threatening calls to Rosenberg. With the Valdez Spice brothers on the run, Castesana knew that the key to cracking the case lay in finding this Canche, the unknown man who had used that 577 number. He was clearly working with the Valdez Spice brothers. But was he a part of their plan? Or were the brothers a part of his? Was this inside man the true author of the crime, the mastermind behind the whole plot. That was exactly what Castresana needed to find out. And the first step in that process was to find out where that 577 phone number came from. Using serial numbers, the CSIG investigators were able to determine that the burner phones used by the inside man and the hitman were both purchased on Tuesday, May 5th. It appeared as if the mysterious man calling himself Ganche had purchased both phones on the same day. He kept one for himself and gave the other to the Valdez Spice brothers to then pass on to the gang of sicarios. CSIG investigators traced the purchase of the phone used by the hitmen to a shopping center in Guatemala City called Centro Comercial Géminis on the second floor. This was on May 5th. The phone had been bought for 349 quetzales, roughly 45 bucks. But it had been paid for in cash, making them unable to identify the purchaser. So that was a dead end. The phone used for the 577 number was also bought on May 5th, but was traced to a different shopping center in Guatemala City, one called La Pradera. The phone was purchased at a Fujifilm kiosk, again, for about 45 bucks. And again, it was paid for in cash. But the investigators got lucky. The sales tax form for the phone had a name on it. The way this works in Guatemala is that whenever you make any kind of purchase, the seller asks you if you want a sales tax form. These forms are used for tax deduction purposes. If you want a sales tax form, you give them your name and tax identification number. If you don't want the form, you don't have to tell them your name. So, for some reason, Ganche had slipped up. Unlike when he purchased the first burner phone, the one used by the hitmen, when he bought the phone using the 577 number, he actually gave his name, which meant the CSIG team could now identify the inside man. They had a name. And that name, the name of the person who bought the phones used by the hitmen and to make those threatening calls, the name of the inside man who had been tracking Rosenberg's movements and who could potentially unlock the entire mystery, was Luis Lopez, Rodrigo Rosenberg's driver. Luis Lopez was a simple man. He didn't have much education. He was older than Rosenberg, quite short, and a little overweight. He had been Rosenberg's driver for years, and they had established a friendly rapport. Lopez functioned like more of a personal assistant than a chauffeur. And like a personal assistant, he was privy to details of Rosenberg's private life that not even his family was aware of. Lopez ran errands for his boss, like fixing his bike, for example. Also, every Tuesday, Lopez was supposed to bring red roses to Rosenberg's apartment before leaving for the day. The flowers were for Marjorie. Lopez knew that Rosenberg was in a relationship with her. That's the extent to which Rosenberg trusted this man. So you can understand why Castresana and his team were so shocked when they discovered that Luis Lopez had purchased the cell phones that were used by the gang of hitmen and by the person making threats to his boss. Was Luis Lopez, this simple, friendly driver, the man who had worked so closely with Rosenberg and for so long, was he really the inside man? Was he really the intellectual author of the murder? Was Luis Lopez capable of intellectually authoring anything? Was it possible that someone else had bought the phones, but had given Lopez's name in order to throw investigators off the scent? The next step was to get a hold of security camera footage from La Pradera, the shopping center where the second phone was purchased. The agents knew that the phone had been bought at exactly 2:01 p.m. on May 5th. They scanned the footage from the shopping center's parking lot first. They saw a white car, registered in the name of Luis Lopez, pull into the parking lot at 1:43 p.m. Next, interior security cameras captured Luis Lopez himself in a chauffeur's black suit and tie, walking through the mall at 1:45 p.m. At 2:04 p.m., 3 minutes after the purchase of the phone was made, cameras recorded Luis Lopez exiting the mall, carrying a green plastic Fujifilm bag in his right hand. Parking lot cameras captured the same image. There was no disputing it. Luis Lopez had indeed purchased the cell phone that had been used to coordinate the murder of Rodrigo Rosenberg. Cicig brought Luis Lopez in for questioning. He was clearly terrified, sweating, and fidgety. They asked him directly about the purchase of the cell phones. They showed him the sales tax form, indicating that he had purchased the phone used for the 577 number. Lopez clammed up. He wouldn't tell them anything. It looked like he was hiding something. And yet, even after a tense interrogation session, Castesana didn't feel like the driver was a viable suspect, let alone the inside man. He just didn't fit the profile. Still, the evidence was incontrovertible. Lopez had definitely been involved. But how? To what extent? The first person Lopez turned to after being released was Eduardo Rosenberg, the son of his late employer. Rosenberg's two grown children, Eduardo and his sister Daniela, were also close with their father's driver. Eduardo was astounded that Cicig had brought Lopez in for questioning. He knew that his father shared things with the driver that he either couldn't or wouldn't share with even his own family, but he couldn't imagine that Lopez was somehow a part of the plot to assassinate his father. Prompted by Rosenberg's son, Luis Lopez contacted Cicig and volunteered for another interview. In this interview, Lopez confirmed that he had indeed bought both of the burner phones. But what he said next floored the investigators. Luis Lopez said that he had bought the cell phones because Rodrigo Rosenberg asked him to, which makes absolutely zero sense, right? According to Lopez, on May 5th, Rosenberg ordered him to buy two prepaid cell phones in different stores. Rosenberg instructed him to purchase the phones with cash and without giving any kind of personal identification. When he bought the first phone, Lopez complied with those instructions. But when he bought the second phone, he forgot. He gave his name, making the mistake that allowed the investigators to trace the purchase back to him. At first, Castesana thought he was lying. After all, why would Rosenberg buy the phones that were used by the men who killed him? The investigators thought that Lopez was either lying through his teeth, which would have made him some kind of Kaiser Sose genius, or, much more likely, that he was being coerced. But the next fact that left them totally befuddled was when Lopez innocently told them that he had been reimbursed for the purchase. Cicig agents then questioned Rosenberg's secretary, who confirmed that on the day he bought the phones, Lopez had come in with receipts for both purchases in order to get a reimbursement. Castesana immediately ruled the driver out as a suspect. It was inconceivable that Lopez had purchased the phones used to coordinate his boss's murder, only to get reimbursed for those purchases by his boss's secretary. That would have been incredibly stupid. Clearly, Lopez was not Canche, the inside man. Lopez went on to recount that Rosenberg had kept one of the cell phones Lopez purchased and then instructed Lopez to give the other phone to the Valdez Spice brothers. That was the same phone the brothers then passed on to Cardona Medina and the gang of hitmen. Now the CSIG team knew that the 577 number that was used to make the threatening calls to Rosenberg's cell phone was at least temporarily in Rosenberg's possession. Okay, hold on a second. Rodrigo Rosenberg ordered his driver to purchase the phones used both by the gang of hitmen and by the inside man? Really? Castesana was baffled. His team was at a total loss. Either this was the most intricate murder conspiracy they had ever come across, something worthy of Agatha Christie or Alan J. Pakula, or it was a complete farce, a Three Stooges-esque jumble of coincidence and happenstance. They were stumped. But there was one more piece of evidence that could potentially crack the case wide open and expose the truth. The location where the 577 number was used to make the threatening calls to Rosenberg and to communicate with the Sicarios. Perhaps, if CC could pinpoint the exact location from where the inside man was making those calls, that could give them a clue as to his identity. After all, he seemed to have been surveilling Rosenberg in real time, even while Rosenberg was riding his bike. He had to have been close by. CSIG investigators obtained cell tower IDs from the 577 number's phone network. During the 5 days in which that phone was used, it was connected to 4 cell towers, each of which provided coverage for Rodrigo Rosenberg's apartment building. That narrowed the location down significantly. Then, by comparing the calls made by the 577 number with the calls made by Rosenberg's personal cell phone, radio frequency experts finally pinpointed the exact location where the threatening calls had been made. They had done it. They had found the spot where the inside man had been when he made those threatening calls to Rosenberg. The investigators had found where the inside man had been when, at exactly 8 a.m. on the morning of May 10th, he called the hitmen to alert them as to Rosenberg's whereabouts. To their astonishment, those calls had been made from inside Rosenberg's apartment.
That's next time on The Rosenberg Case. If you don't want to wait to find out what happens next on The Rosenberg Case, be sure to subscribe to Cavalry Plus only on the Apple Podcast app to get next week's episode right now, ad-free. Trust me, you won't want to miss it.